Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the wake of a bloodless missile strike on U.S. forces by Iran, President Trump on Wednesday reiterated his justification for the U.S. drone strike last week that killed Iranian military commander Qassem Soleimani, that there was an imminent attack on Americans.
Soleimani's hands were drenched in both American and Iranian blood. He should have been terminated long ago. By removing Soleimani, we have sent a powerful message to terrorists. If you value your own life, you will not threaten the lives of our people.
But Democrats and even a couple Republicans briefed on the matter yesterday have raised concerns about the strategy. Here's Virginia Democrat Jerry Connolly on Wednesday.
Without commenting on content, my reaction to this briefing was it was sophomoric and utterly unconvincing. And I believe more than ever, the Congress needs to act to protect the constitutional provisions about war and peace.
Talking national politics today with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
So we just heard there from Virginia Democrat Jerry Connolly speaking to reporters after that White House briefing yesterday on the Trump administration's justification for killing Soleimani. Several lawmakers have said the briefings, as he did, were unconvincing. And that word sophomoric harkens, you know, was sort of not repeated exactly, but there was references like that from even Republicans. They also felt that they were not allowed to ask tough questions or voice dissent. You know, what about the politics of war in a presidential election year?
Well, that's a great question. And first of all, I have to tell you that I have a mixed minus problem right now. I'm hearing an echo of my sound, so it is going to be a little difficult. But having said that, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. It's gone away. Well, here's the thing, though. This is supposed to be a secure briefing for members of Congress. And yes, we just did hear from Democrat Jerry Connolly. And of course, Democrats are expected to be complaining. But Mike Lee, the Republican senator from Utah, also came out to the reporters and said, this is a disaster. This was an insult. And the fact is, if this is a secure briefing and we're told not to discuss security matters because it's classified, but that's the whole purpose of a secure briefing. So members of both parties were not satisfied, and yet there was a sense of calm almost when you listened to President Trump's address to the nation. You know, all is well, he said, and there's a sense that all is well. How Iran responded, nobody was killed, even though Iran reported that there were 80 American deaths. Maybe that was to satisfy critics at home. But it seems like the raising of temperatures has come down, of course, for anybody to think that this is the end of the crisis, and that's the end of the back and forth between the two superpowers. I think they'd be mistaken.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest, of course, is Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. He joins us a couple times a month right now, thankfully, because it's a busy, busy season in Politicsville in the United States. If you have a question or comment for Ken this hour, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I mentioned at the top of the hour how the president famously predicted that his predecessor, Barack Obama, would go to war with Iran in order to get reelected. I think that was in 2011 or I guess it was 2012.
2011, yes.
And, you know, that has a lot of people scratching their heads at the timing of this episode.
Well, here's the thing. Not only did Donald Trump, who was then not a candidate, go on to talk in 2011 about how Barack Obama will use the war against Iran to help him win re-election. Of course, that did not happen. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that he is still, we have seen from the president's actions and his words, that he is still obsessed about Barack Obama. Even in his address to the nation, everything is fine, all is well. By the way, it's the money that came from the Iranian rockets that were launched on, the missiles that were launched on the U.S. air base in Iraq, were paid for by the previous administration. He cannot let go of his antipathy for Barack Obama. And And, you know, every time you think, well, that's a good speech, and, you know, as Lindsey Graham said, that was a very effective speech. It showed great leadership. I don't know why 3 years after the election, and he didn't even defeat Barack Obama, but 3 years after he took office, he's still obsessing over the previous president.
Well, what do you make of that?
It's Donald Trump. It's the deflection. It's the pointing to others. Just like he would, you know, he would attack others when there's a charge leveled against President Trump. He'll use those exact same words and point his fingers to somebody else, whether it's true or not. And the point is that if he's not self-congratulating regarding the economy and foreign policy, whenever there's bad news, it's always somebody else's fault.
There was a fact check in the Washington Post. It probably came out yesterday. I saw it this morning, going bit by bit over his comments from yesterday. Bragging about the economy, bragging about the unemployment rate, bragging about the military and how he's built up the military. In fact, hardly any money's been spent on the military, and much of what's there is the function of his predecessors.
And if we're talking about fact-checking, mm-hmm. the fact that the president always keeps saying that Iran used the money that the United States gave him mm-hmm. As part of the Iranian deal, well, this was just the freeing of funds that were just bottled up until the deal was signed. But he keeps repeating this falsehood about the United States
handing over. It was Iranian money, yeah.
Iranian money, right, exactly. It was Iranian money to begin with, exactly. But the fact is, he keeps saying that the United States gave, the United States under Obama and Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, gave the Iranian regime billions of dollars.
Let's talk about Senator Mike Lee of Utah and Rand Paul of Kentucky. They said they would support a Senate version of a House resolution to rein in President Trump's ability to wage war with Iran. Rand Paul, not so surprising. Senator Mike Lee, I don't know that much about him, but what kind of risk is he running? Lindsey Graham came out right away and criticized him for his comments.
Mike Lee basically is no risk at all.
Okay.
The fact is that of all the states, and you think of the conservative Red Rock or Republican states, Utah did not overwhelmingly go for Donald Trump because there's a lot of concerns in the heavily Mormon population about ethical problems and personal conduct problems that many Republicans seem to ignore in 2016, but Utah Republicans did not. I think that's part of one of the reasons that Mitt Romney is so free to criticize, even though he's not up for re-election for a long time. And Mike Lee isn't up for re-election for a long time either. But Mike Lee represents that Utah Republican who is basically, first of all, he's always been one of those constitutional experts who says that, you know, you need to follow the Constitution. And if you vary from that, you should pay the price, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Rand Paul is interesting, too, because he often says the same thing. But then at the end, he buckles down and, like, he'll say, well, I'm not going to vote for this nominee because he's a war hawk. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly he votes for him. So Rand Paul seems to bluff more than Mike Lee, but Mike Lee seems serious. But here's the thing. Obviously, the House, and I think the vote is today, the House is going to vote to use the War Powers Act to put a little check on the president when it comes to waging war in Iran, or at least military action against Iran. For the Senate, it's difficult. You need four Republicans to break ranks with the United Democratic Front if it's going to pass. So maybe you have Mike Lee, but who else do you have?
Right.
Do you have Susan Collins in Maine, who's up for re-election? Do you have Cory Gardner in Colorado? So there are a lot of vulnerable Republicans who are watching this vote very, very carefully, and who know that whatever vote, however they vote on the war or even impeachment, mm-hmm. The voters back home will send a verdict in November.
What about Murkowski in Alaska?
She's also one of those interesting characters. I mean, she has also said, when it comes to impeachment, for example, that she says that I disagree with the way Mitch McConnell is running the show, that they should be witnesses. Susan Collins, who's up for re-election, Murkowski is not. Mm-hmm. Susan Collins says, I'm going along with the leader, which is very, very interesting. But watch Murkowski. Remember, she was one of those three Republicans, along with Collins and the late John McCain, who basically put a kibosh on the overturning of the Obamacare, mm-hmm. those three Republicans who broke with their party. Watch Murkowski, watch Mitt Romney. We'll see what happens.
As we know, as you said already, the House will vote today on a measure to rein in President Trump's ability to wage war with Iran. But and the Senate, there may be a Senate version of something along that line as well. But this is kind of ceremonial, isn't it? Or it's not. It's symbolic. It is not anything that could really rein in his powers, could it?
Well, I mean, that it's a fair question. But the fact is that whatever you think of the Bush incursion into Iraq, he did go to Congress when George H.W. Bush did the Persian Gulf War in 1990, did the Persian Gulf War, when they sent troops to wage war against Saddam Hussein in 1991. He did go to Congress. So, again, and Lyndon Johnson, you know, in the Gulf of Tonkin, which is perhaps a bogus reason to send tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops to Vietnam, he still had a resolution passed by Congress. So I don't think it's window dressing only. I think the fact is if the Congress goes on record, especially if a Republican Senate goes on record trying to tie the president down or at least keep him accountable, I think it sends a very strong message.
So some senators on Wednesday introduced a resolution stressing that neither to the 2001 nor the 2002 authorization for the use of military force, obviously that goes to the immediate post 9/11 era, covers a potential war with Iran. Is that what the Trump administration has been saying authorizes him to move forward on this stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
To be honest with you, I think the president has, I don't mean to be cutesy here, but I think the president just feels that he can do what he wants, mm-hmm. and he has been doing what he wants. And if he has members of the cabinet who feel that this is beyond constitutional borders, these cabinet members are no longer members of the cabinet. So it's been his way or the highway for many of the president's actions. I think for Congress, I mean, Congress has yet to stand up to him on many, many things. And the few times that has happened, they have been unable to override a veto. But this would send a very strong signal, again, as they say, mm-hmm. if the Republican Senate, if they got four Republicans to vote with the Democrats and the Republican Senate said, hold on, Mr. President, you're going too far, or at least you have a responsibility to Congress before you take action, that would be a big step.
Before Iran retaliated, President Trump had promised massive retaliation to any Iranian hostility, especially if any Americans were killed. He even threatened to strike Iranian cultural sites, which is pretty anathema. Now, the military did respond immediately to that and say, yeah, we're not committing that crime. That's a war crime. But I'm wondering, did you see any response from Republicans to that notion?
Yeah, well, exactly right. I mean, until the Secretary of Defense announced that this would be a war crime or say that we are not going that far, there was pretty much silence from the Republicans on this. Although there was some, I mean, Lindsey Graham, I can never know what to make of him because mm-hmm. once upon a time, he was the number one Trump critic. That was back in 2015, 2016. And now he's been the number one sycophant who has basically given the president a pass on everything he does. But he's still, Lindsey Graham, who is up for re-election this year, still has now and then will say that there are lines you can't cross. And he also said that cultural sites are out of bounds. I don't think the president realized when he said cultural sites that this would be considered a war crime. And once he did say he would respect that.
We are talking with political journalist Ken Rudin. He's host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for Ken Rudin, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking national politics today. And what's dominated the political conversations for days on end now is Iran. My guest is Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. He's joining us a couple times a month now to talk about these things as we wade into the 2020 presidential election cycle. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So has this this crisis with Iran, Ken Rudin, has it distracted people from the impeachment?
Well, you know, something is that's a very good point, because when lawmakers came into, and when voters as well came into 2020, all we kept thinking about were the elections and impeachment. Little did we think of that a brewing war, perhaps a possible war in the Middle East would be a part of the calculation. Let me just say one quick thing about this before we leave this subject completely. The lawmakers are still waiting for kind of a justification for the killing of General Soleimani, and they did not get that in the briefing, because remember the line was that he was killed because there was going to be an attack from Iranian proxy forces that was imminent. And then they said, well, it was really retaliation for the killing of an American contractor. So lawmakers went into the briefing that was given by Mike Pompeo and Mark Esper and others to get some kind of answers, and they did not get that. So Iran does not go away anytime soon, and it really has pushed impeachment off the front pages.
But we'll still talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has accused House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of, quote, shameless game playing. That's a new phrase for politics on Wednesday.
I've never heard of that.
I've never heard of shameless game playing before when it comes to politics. But she's also facing pressure from members of her own party to get those impeachment articles to Senate. What do you make of her strategy still holding out on those articles of impeachment?
Well, you know something, I've been saying for the past year that Nancy Pelosi has been an incredible strategist, that she understood her caucus better than anybody else, and the way she walked through the minefields of impeachment in the House, she was incredible. But she seems to be outsmarted by Mitch McConnell, who is as canny and has been in the Senate longer than she's been in the House. He's been in the Senate since 1984, and he knows the ropes, and he knows exactly what to do. As a matter of fact, as we saw with Merrick Garland, who's not on the Supreme Court, Mitch McConnell is perhaps maybe the most powerful politician in Washington, maybe except for President Trump. But anyway, the fact is he knows the rules. He is not bending. He feels and he says that the House had its say during the impeachment debate, and now it's up to the Senate, not the House, not Nancy Pelosi, to tell us what to do. And he even has some Democrats like Dianne Feinstein and others who are saying, okay, you know, you push through the impeachment thing in the House, let's get it out of the way and let's get it done with, because nobody thinks that the president is going to be convicted or and removed by the Senate. But once, like John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, says, well, I'd like to testify if I'm subpoenaed, of course, the House Democrats wanted him to testify there, and he wouldn't.
Right.
But once they started talking about John Bolton testifying, then Nancy Pelosi says, wait a second, I want some leverage in the Senate, but she's not likely to get it.
So explain to me, McConnell saying that they just want to get the process underway. They can't do that until they get the articles of impeachment from the House. But they're going to wait as far as taking testimony or having witnesses. That's not a guarantee that there'll be witnesses. They're just going to wait and decide on that later, right?
That is correct. Okay. He says they're going to have the debate. They're going to have the pass the rules of the debate, and then they'll decide if John Bolton or anybody else will testify. My guess is that they won't be. My guess is that I don't believe, if memory serves, I don't think there were any witnesses who testified in the Clinton Senate impeachment trial in 1999. I think we just heard the arguments by the House managers, and Nancy Pelosi announced that Adam Schiff will probably be the lead House manager when the argument comes to the Senate. But ultimately, it's going to be cut and dry that, you know, you don't have two-thirds of a Senate willing to push mm-hmm. President Trump out of office. So, I mean, I think it's one of those foregone conclusions that we know the result well in advance, but I don't think the Democrats and Nancy Pelosi are that willing to give up so quickly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. And Sharon in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to throw this out there because I've heard this from several people, and I'd like Ken's feedback on it. Is there something about if we are at war, then the current president should or must stay in office until certainly not until the war is over. But there's something, maybe it's even just in people's thinking, oh, well, we better keep him in there because, you know, it started with him and he's familiar with what's going on and he should stay. And I wonder if he's using that with his, what I call, you know, his trying to take us into war, clearly.
Ken, so there's a couple questions there. There's a strategy that plays on people's fears. And then then Sharon's asking, is there a rule or a law or anything? There is not, right?
That's correct. I mean, Sharon is actually talking about two different things. Yeah. When you think of presidents at war in 1944, Franklin D. Roosevelt was seeking a fourth term. And even though we were in the middle of World War II and the voters could have voted for Thomas Dewey or for FDR, and they chose FDR, Lyndon Johnson, for a brief time, was running for re-election in 1968 during the Vietnam War. Now, ultimately, he decided not to run.
Right.
But again, it was up to the voters. But at the same time, there is a strong feeling, or at least a widespread feeling in the country, and it's always been the case, that there's a rally around the president factor, that we don't change horses in the middle of a war. You know, I think that's that expression has been around for decades in presidential politics. Now, and of course, the Trump, like Kevin McCarthy, for example, the House minority leader, said, I can't believe we're talking about impeachment when we're at war. And I think Lou Dobbs of Fox News said the same thing. That is an argument that's mostly out of emotion and certainly not out of any legal standing. There is no law that keeps a president from being defeated for re-election or impeached and removed from office just because we're in a war.
But it's the very strategy that Donald Trump accused Barack Obama of, even though we never went to war with Iran during the Obama administration. But that's what he was talking about back then in 2011.
Well, he was talking about the president getting involved in a war to help his reelection.
Right.
I think what Sharon is saying is that is there a feeling in the country that you cannot remove a president because of in the middle of a war, and there is no such law like that.
Okay. Sharon, thanks for that call. Anybody else? 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about John Bolton. Why would he do that? Why would he offer to testify at the impeachment trial in the Senate. I mean, what's going on there? Because,
you know, I honestly don't understand. And of course, if you ask the President, Trump will say that Bolton knows nothing and is not privy to any information, and it's a waste of time. But the fact is that the House made it clear, the Democratic-run House made it clear that they wanted Bolton to testify. And of course, President Trump, you know, unlike President Clinton, who did not stop members of his administration from testifying, did not block documents, Trump would not allow anybody in his administration, his Secretary of State, his Chief of Staff, all those people from testifying. And Bolton said, well, you know something, if I'm subpoenaed, I'll testify. And there are some questions, even Mitch McConnell is saying to the Democrats in the House, well, how come you didn't subpoena John Bolton? The answer, as Adam Schiff said, well, if we subpoena and he rejects it, then it goes to the court. This will be extended for months at a time, and we just don't want to do that. Of course, this goes back to Mitch McConnell's argument. Well, if the Democrats in the House were in such a rush to impeach the president, what's taking so long for bringing the articles of impeachment to the Senate? But having said that, I don't understand what John Bolton is doing. He keeps writing. I follow him on Twitter, and every now and then he'll say, you know, I have these great ideas, and Trump shouldn't be doing this. And the response on Twitter is, my God, why don't you testify? Why don't you why save this for Twitter? Go before the American people. But I just don't know what he's doing. I don't.
It's another example, though, just listening to you talk about this, of how Twitter has changed.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, I hate it.
I know.
I hate it, and I'm addicted to it. That's really what it is. It's just I can't turn away from it, but there's so much lies, so much misinformation, so much anger and hostility and vitriol on Twitter that every now and then I'm saying, just don't look at it, and then it's like one of those car crash things.
Yeah.
You just can't keep your eyes closed.
I'm embarrassed to say I didn't check if the president tweeted today yet.
I didn't notice it either.
It didn't pop up.
No, I did not see that.
Sounds like it's something I'm getting paid to do, but I didn't do it.
No. I'm still used to the fireside chats. No, I'm really not.
I know, the good old days. Let's see, Dale in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Dale.
Hi. If Adam Schiff is the House manager in the impeachment trial, would he be held to the same perjury standards in the trial there?
Would he be held to what? I'm sorry?
Would he, for perjury standards, is he required to tell the truth in front of the Senate trial?
Well, that's a... the answer I think is no.
Testifying, right?
Well, he's not testifying. He's going to be making the case. I mean, that's like saying, you know, during the Clinton impeachment trial, you had Henry Hyde and Jim Rogan and Steve Chabot and others, you know, from the House Judiciary Committee, who tried to make the case against Bill Clinton. Nobody was questioning whether they were bound by under threat of perjury for not telling the truth. I have not heard that. No, I think what Republicans have tried to do is they've tried to turn the tables and make it about Joe Biden and Adam Schiff, not the president's conduct. But you know, that's not likely to happen.
Thanks a lot, Dale, for that call. Everybody else, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When's the next debate?
Well, the debate is next Tuesday, yeah. And that's interesting about that because it's January 14th, and it's possible, I mean, of course, that date is not set in stone in the event that there is a Senate trial, if the Senate trial begins by then, because you have a bunch of senators. You have Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar and, also Cory Booker, although he's not going to be in the debate. Mm-hmm. But you have senators who are going to be in the debate and in the impeachment trial. So I suspect that if the impeachment trial does start that week, they will push back the debate, perhaps even to the following Monday, which is Dr. King's birthday. But right now it's scheduled for the 14th. Only five, compared to 10, but only five Democrats have qualified so far. Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar. Not yet Tom Steyer, not yet Andrew Yang, not yet Cory Booker. And tomorrow is the deadline to qualify, and it doesn't look like any of those other three will make it. So, you know, you need 5% in four approved polls. You need 225,000 unique donors, and those five have it. And everybody's saying, well, what about Michael Bloomberg, who has spent more money than all the other candidates, including President Trump, combined? But to get in the debates, you have to have individual donors. And Michael Bloomberg says, I'm not taking anybody else's money because I don't want to be beholden to anybody else. Mm-hmm. I'll spend my own money. But that's very laudable of you, Mr. Bloomberg, but it's not going to get you into a debate.
Right. How critical do you think being in the debate is?
Well, you know, I never know the answer to that. I am glued to it. I watch mm-hmm. everything, and I love talking about winners and losers and who did well and who didn't. But for example, look, in 2016, I thought Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in every debate. I thought she was far superior to him, and he won the election. I always think of this is vice presidential, but I think of Dan Quayle in the 1988 debates when he looked like the deer in the headlights with Lloyd Benson, and yet the Bush-Quayle ticket won 40 out of 50 states. So ultimately, I don't know what it means, but let's face it, Julian Castro, I thought, made an ill-advised attack on Joe Biden's age and memory, and he's out of the race. So sometimes the debates do tell, look, Rick Perry, who couldn't remember the third institution of government that he would cut, that's what the
which was the Department of Commerce, I think, which was that?
It was commerce, it was energy. He couldn't remember the third. And everybody said, oh, what a loser. That's the kind of thing that would eliminate a candidate in 2012, not everything Donald Trump has done now. It's remarkable what used to be a disqualifying thing for a presidential candidate. Now that's so antiquated and quaint.
Quaint,
I mean,
right.
now anything goes.
Tim in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Tim.
Hey, just one question. As far as the House impeachment, in light of the new evidence, could they recant or add to the articles of impeachment against Trump?
Did you get that, Ken?
I think what Tim is saying is that in the House they are talking about new evidence that could lead to more impeachment articles against the president. And if that's what Tim is saying, mm-hmm. he is correct. I mean, I can't imagine members of the House, let alone the American public, wanting yet another article of impeachment, given what's going to happen in the Senate. Mm-hmm. But the House is talking about it, and the House apparently has uncovered some other documents. But, you know, I think it seems like it's like throwing stuff against a wall, and people are not going to. It's remarkable to me that the evidence is not important anymore. It's the political weariness of this country that they can't. They've gone through the impeachment in the House. The House had their say. They had their opportunity, and everything else may be too little, too late. Even if they have more indictable and indictable stuff on the president.
What is the role of the Chief Justice John Roberts in all of this? I know he presides, but what does that even mean?
He plays a major role because senators are not allowed to talk during the trial at all. They're not allowed to say a word. And if you could imagine Chuck Schumer going 5 minutes without talking, let alone an entire day, I mean, it's remarkable. So,
it's the minority
so
leader,
basically,
right?
as William Rehnquist did during the Clinton impeachment, John Roberts will play a critical role. I don't know if we'll hear any getting signals from him. I think he's just going to be a referee.
Well, could he say he wants to hear testimony?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he wants it. Just because he wants it doesn't mean it'll happen. Mitch McConnell will run the show on that. And again, if there's going to be testimony, it's going to have to be from four brave Republicans who are going to have to break from McConnell to make it happen. And right now, as Mitch McConnell says he has the votes to keep that from happening. He may be right.
Tim, thanks for that call. We're talking with a political journalist, host of Ken Rood's. He's also host of Ken Rood's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. It's Ken Rudin. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Laura Trump, Eric's wife, and was in Ohio yesterday, and I think she was in Columbus, and President Trump is slated to hold a rally tonight in Toledo. He won big in Ohio in 2016. He's counting on taking the Buckeye State in November. How's he doing in Ohio and other key swing states at this point, Ken?
He doesn't have that lead that he had in 2016 in Ohio. But I will tell you one thing about it, which is very interesting. And I think people, this is really under the radar, and it shouldn't be. While the Democrats are eating their own and having their debates and beating up on each other, Donald Trump is holding rallies in those key states that elected him in 2016, in Florida, in Ohio, in Michigan, in Wisconsin, and he's drawing huge crowds. And given the fact that he's all but unopposed for the Republican nomination, I mean, there are, you know, there's Bill Weld and there's Joe Walsh, and but there are going to be no debates. It's really not a contest for a renomination. He has the opportunity and the freedom to just have these campaign rallies, these general election campaign rallies, where he's packing them in these key states. So at some point, the Democrats are going to have to unite behind a candidate, mm-hmm. because right now the president is doing all the smart things when it comes to 2020's reelection, and that is campaign. You know, the last I looked, there were like 50 states or 48. I don't know. There are a lot of states in this country, but there are only about four or five that will matter in 2020, Ohio being one of them, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida, Wisconsin, and Trump is campaigning in all of them right now.
Let's see. David in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I'm wondering, with Michael Bloomberg's great wealth, could he just organize his own debate and invite whoever wants to come on with him?
Ken?
Well, I don't know any. I mean, I don't know any candidate who wants to give Michael Bloomberg more attention. Although Michael Bloomberg is not lacking for attention, because I don't know about you, and I assume it's the same in Ohio as it is here in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington D.C. But I can't turn on the TV mm-hmm. without seeing a Michael Bloomberg commercial. And I will tell you that I think his commercials are excellent.
I do
they're
too.
Very effective. I think they're really, really good. Now
he's
I know
talking about the issue. Yeah. That got
and
Republicans back the House, which is health care.
He is, I think, it is the best commercials I've seen. And of course, he's not standing for he's not running in Iowa or New Hampshire or Nevada or South Carolina. He's waiting for Super Tuesday on March 3rd to make his bid, which is a very risky strategy, but the fact is he has the wherewithal, the financial wherewithal, to make it happen. I think his commercials are excellent. I think now there's also a rumor, and this would enrage the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing of the party. There's a rumor that after maybe the January or February debate, or maybe that they will relax the standards for contributors to participate in the debates, which would allow Bloomberg to get in there. Because right now, he's spending on debates and he's not answering to any critics. He's not being ripped apart in any debates because he's not part of the debates. He would like to be part of the debates, but right now I think for somebody who's not on stage with those other candidates, he is still very effective.
Okay, David, thanks for that call. The Democratic field, as you mentioned, is narrowing. It's becoming also less diverse. Julian Castro ended his campaign, quickly endorsed Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Is that much of a boost to her campaign? Does that matter much at this point?
Well, I don't know. Once upon a time, I mean, everything, what's fascinating, there's so many fascinating things to me, but let me just go back in history one quick second. Back in 2004, all eyes were on Howard Dean and, for lesser part, Dick Gephardt. They were the leaders in Iowa for a long time, especially Howard Dean, because, you know, everybody was really excited about his opposition to the war and his the introduction of online politics and things like that. But then, Iowa voters are notoriously known for deciding late. And the fact is that as Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean started fighting towards the end, the third and fourth place finishers moved up, and that were John Kerry and John Edwards. Voters decided that I like the charisma, I like the excitement, but I need somebody who could beat President Bush. And they thought that John Kerry was the top candidate to do that. Ultimately, I think that voters are going to decide who can beat President Trump in November, and that would ultimately be the decision. But right now, everything is really, really in flux. And I mean, right now, Pete Buttigieg seems to be the darling in Iowa. But a few months ago, we were talking about Elizabeth Warren, how she was had an answer for everything. She had accomplishments and a solid explanations for what she wants to do. But now it seems like everybody is less satisfied with her, that the far left says she's backing off on Medicare for All, and the center say she can't win because she's too liberal. So I don't know what a Julian Castro endorsement means. You know, I think endorsements are overrated anyway. But right now everybody seems to be talking about maybe Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden still leading nationally, and don't count out Amy Klobuchar, who of course lives across the street from Iowa in Minnesota. If she doesn't win in Iowa or come in a close second, I think her campaign is over. But she has also impressed a lot of people who are deciding for the first time.
I don't know why. She had a little bit of bad kind of negative personality press early on.
She would berate her staff.
Yeah, right. That kind of stuff.
She would throw a fork at them. But she is charming in the debates. I mean, anybody.
She's had a couple zingers, hasn't she? Yeah.
Yeah, she has. Some people think she's trying to be too cute. I think she is adorable in a fun way, and not a looks thing. Yeah. But she also, I mean, the fact that she's talking about she's gotten so much money from her ex-boyfriends, those things kind of stand out. But it's funny the kind of things we focus on. Yeah. Two debates ago, she looked like she was shaking and her hair was shaking. And I couldn't ignore that the whole debate. So it's amazing. There were so many important things.
It's that HDTV.
Well,
you can
that'll
see
do it.
So much.
But that's it. I mean, the fact that we focus on, you know, a tick or shaking or this, and there's so much important stuff that is not being addressed that desperately needs to be addressed. And I'm not saying it's just the media, it's just a lot of people, but we just seem to focus on the weirdest things sometimes. And then when the election is over, it's like, what were we thinking? Oh, my.
Have you seen the movie Bombshell?
I have. And I recommend it. And there's two things that people need to see about that. Bombshell was the movie which focused on the women who were harassed and by Roger Ailes. There's also The Loudest Voice, which was on Showtime, which is starring Russell Crowe as Roger Ailes. That was spectacular. Mm-hmm. But both of them talked about his domination of Fox News and how he did things his way and according to his whim. And my goodness, it was, you know, you don't have to be a raging liberal to like the show, because the treatment of women should be universal. It should not be only a liberal or a democratic platform. It should be everybody should feel the same way about abuse of women, and especially by men in power. Both the movie Bombshell and The Loudest Voice on Television exemplified that.
I thought it was interesting how the characters, you know, I don't know if Gretchen Carlson and Megyn Kelly actually said this, although I can visualize it saying, I'm not a feminist. I just don't like how he treats women kind of a thing.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. If you remember, accusations by Gretchen Carlson and so many in Fox News were silent, and even Megyn Kelly. And then Megyn Kelly, when everybody was asked to sign their loyalty to Roger Ailes, mm-hmm. Megyn Kelly wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. She didn't do it, and ultimately she came out. She became a very important voice in the case against Ailes' sexual harassment. So mm-hmm. she played a very key role, not only in the movie but in real life.
And do you think that it ultimately did cost them their careers in the final analysis, Gretchen Carlson and Megyn Kelly? And
well, Roger Ailes was still controlling the things back then. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the fact that once Megyn Kelly proved that she was not loyal to Roger Ailes, you had people like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity who turned her off, you know, cast her aside as a traitor. You know, if you don't follow the line, as Shepard Smith learned, if you don't follow the line 100%, you're persona non grata. And so if it's not the president who's attacking you, it's the Tucker Carlsons and Sean Hannitys who are attacking you. And that's sad because there are some very good, I mean, Chris Wallace is superb on Fox. I hope he never goes away. But Shepard Smith was fair, and that, you know, fair and balanced is one thing in on a slogan, but in reality, it's not always acceptable.
Hmm. Let's see. We got a call here from Alan in Clintonville. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you all this morning?
Good, thanks.
I was calling because I'm wondering if anyone has noticed the supreme irony of a commander-in-chief running as a war president who dodged the draft 5 times and couldn't recall at a certain point how he got out of it, just that he got out of it.
Well, I mean, I don't think people are ignoring that at all. Matter of fact, I've seen a lot of remarks on social media saying that if there's a draft, I'm going to claim that I have bone spurs. So I mean, there are a lot of people who resent that. And the same argument was made against George W. Bush during the war in Iraq, when he sought deferments and tried to get out of the war. And Bill Clinton, too, with his weaseling, I didn't mean to use that word, but his wiggling his way out of serving and things like that. And yet one of the greatest presidents, wartime presidents, was Franklin D. Roosevelt, who, of mm-hmm. course, did not serve in office as well, in wartime as well, either. So, but yes, I think that there are a lot of people who have not lost sight of the fact that Donald Trump, look, we're not in a war yet. There is no institution of a draft. We don't have World War III. And for all we know, maybe the killing of Soleimani and then the retaliation with the rockets, maybe that does it for now. If that is the case, I think the world can breathe a sigh of relief.
Thank you, Alan, for that call. Weirdly, Andrew Yang didn't get on the ballot in Ohio. They made some kind of clerical error, and that's that. You know, he doesn't get on. And I just wonder, is he serious anymore? Is this
It is remarkable to me that you have senators, you know, you have all these governors. You had Hickenlooper of Colorado and Steve Bullock of Montana. And you had senators like Kamala Harris and Kirsten Gillibrand, people who have served in office who just could not make it. And you have Andrew Yang, who's a very good campaigner. I think he's very good in the debates. He's very charming and likable. And he's still, you know, one of the top 5, top 6 serious candidates.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that says about the system, but look, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the American people are looking for, but look who they elected in 2016, and half the country is very happy with that. So, you know, I mean, the old days of smoke-filled rooms and, you know the Joe Bidens of the world who were in the Senate for 75 years, those are the people they would put forward for nominees. The American people are asking for different things now, not the politics as usual.
Ken Rudin, we're just about out of time, but I, you know, Philip Bump in the Washington Post just wrote about something of that the when they talk about the percentage of the Republican Party that supports President Trump, the actual raw numbers of the Republican Party have shrunk since his election, that people are defecting and that the percentage doesn't mean the same thing. What do you think of that?
There may be some truth to that, but until I see that in Congress, it's really not going to make that much of a deal. Now, I would think that if that is the case with Republican voters, Republican members of Congress would follow suit. But right now, they're still following the president, all the way. And I mean, unless there's a big backlash against the president, they're going to stay in office until then. But it's fascinating to watch.
Ken Rudin, as always, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ann. I love being with you.
Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. You can learn more about that at the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.